This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This week, amidst the swirling muck of this election campaign, President Obama gave a shout-out to science.
I'm a science geek. I'm a nerd. And I don't make any apologies for it. I don't make any apologies for it. It's cool stuff.
He was speaking at the White House Frontiers Conference in Pittsburgh. In attendance was my next guest, a proud science journalist. Don't know if she's a geek. We'll ask her. Nadia Drake. She's a science writer with National Geographic, and she joins us from WESA in Pittsburgh. Welcome back.
Hi, Ira. Thank you for having me. And I am definitely a geek.
That's two in the room now.
Exactly.
You were at this conference and you saw the president speak. Was there any news or mainly just a feel-good event?
Well, it was mostly an event that was attended by a number of scientists and policymakers and innovators who were getting together to consider the future of various topics, including things like interplanetary exploration and personalized medicine, artificial intelligence, smart cities and smart transportation, and climate change.
Yeah, a lot of interesting things for the future, I guess, for any next president to tackle.
Absolutely.
Elsewhere this week, there's a story about a virus lifting some genes from the black widow spider.
Tell us about that. So I think it's easiest to consider the story as kind of like the biological version of Russian nesting dolls, you know, where smaller and smaller and smaller dolls are tucked into one another. That's a useful framework for thinking about what I'm going to tell you next, which is that in this case, we're not dealing with dolls, but with a virus that tucks itself inside a type of bacteria that tucks itself into spiders and insects. The virus is called WO, and that's spelled capital W, capital O, like WO.
WO.
And WO, exactly. And it infects a bacteria called Wolbachia, which in turn is found inside animals, such as insects and spiders. Now, what's interesting is that the virus's genome contains some snippets of animal genes, including those that produce venom in black widow spiders. In fact, one-third of its genome is basically a hodgepodge of various animal genes, and that's something that scientists did not think could happen. So,
Wow. So over the life evolution of this virus, it went around picking up genes from things it infected.
Yes. So that's one of the questions that scientists are trying to answer, is how exactly did a spider gene end up in the viral genome?
Wow.
Because normally you only see viruses grabbing genes from the organisms that they actually infect, which in this case is not the spider or the insects, but the bacteria that lives inside them. So viruses that infect bacteria normally only steal bacterial genes. Viruses that infect animals like spiders and insects will steal genes from the spiders and insects. But this is the first time that virologists have seen animal-like DNA tucked into a viral genome that normally only infects bacteria.
Boy, the mind could go wild with this. Let's move on to the next story. There's news from your home, National Geo, this week, right, about some ancient footprints.
That's right, yeah. So in northern Tanzania, near Arusha, there's a volcano that the Maasai call the Mountain of God. And near that volcano is a mud flat the size of a tennis court that is crisscrossed by more than 400 prehistoric human footprints that could be as many as 19,000 years old. It's the largest such assemblage of ancient human footprints found in Africa. And scientists think that all of those footprints were laid down over a period of hours to days. Some of them show people jogging, keeping upwards of a 12-minute per mile pace. Others show groups of maybe a dozen people, mostly women and children, walking together. And there's a track that looks like it was made by a person who might have had a broken toe.
They can get that granular with it. Wow.
Yeah, it's really amazing. Interesting.
Where was it found? In Tanzania, I understand?
Right, in northern Tanzania, near the Kenyan border.
Yeah, well, we know where the fertile ground, Tanzania is, Olduvai Gorge and all that kind of stuff there.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah. Let's go to space. Now, the moon may be more liable to craters than we thought. Is that what you're hearing?
Yeah, so it seems kind of obvious that the moon is constantly being pummeled. So craters are one of its most distinctive features. But it's the rate at which these craters appeared recently that surprised scientists. So a group of scientists studied images that were taken by NASA's Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which has been orbiting the moon since 2009. And what they found after scanning through more than 14,000 before and after images taken of the same sites were 222 new impact craters, all made over the last 7 years. And that's 33% more craters than were expected for those that are at least 10 meters across. So something that a school bus could fit into, for example.
Mm-hmm. So is there worry then if we went back to the moon that, you know, we might get hit by something that's making more craters? Because there are more craters than we thought?
So what's concerning here in terms of a moon base, for example, is that the cratering rate is a lot higher than what we had expected. So that means that any future lunar base, which is a really fun thing to think about, would need to be somewhat more fortified against these collisions from outer space because there are more of them happening at, you know, and faster than we expected.
Well, that'd be pretty strong fortification for something incoming like that. Finally, some other astronomy research, but it's probably not aliens, but looks like something might be.
Someday it will be aliens, but
maybe not
today
this time.
Is not that day.
What are we talking about here?
So scientists were looking through some spectra taken of stars in the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, and they found 243 stars, the spectra of which contained a periodicity that could be mimicking what we might expect to find from an extraterrestrial civilization. It is extremely unlikely that that periodicity is being caused by aliens, but it's more likely that it's an artifact of the instrument itself.
That's measuring it, huh?
Right, exactly.
So the star is sort of is blinking at a certain rate that you might think is sending us Morse code signals or something like that.
Yeah, so basically, it's a little more complicated, but there is something that someday could be alien Morse code, but...
Takes a little more, as Sagan used to say, a little more evidence than extraordinary evidence needed for.
Yes, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence.
Thank you, Nadia. That's great stuff.
Yeah, thank you.
Nadia Drake, science writer with National Geographic. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. Reservoirs, you know, those lake-like bodies of water. They provide flood control, irrigation, drinking water, electric power, recreation. Beautiful and environmentally friendly, no? Well, we have such great drinking water in New York because of these reservoirs. So, well, turns out maybe not. A recent study shows that reservoirs are also an unforeseen emitter of greenhouse gases. If you put all the reservoirs together, they produce as much methane and CO2 as the entire country of Canada, which is the ninth largest greenhouse gas-emitting country in the world. So why are reservoirs such a carbon contradiction? Joining me to discuss the good and the bad is John Harrison, Associate Professor, School of Environment at Washington State University in Vancouver, Washington. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. It's great to be here.
Well, we've been building reservoirs for centuries. That's because they're very useful, so that's got to be a good thing, right?
Well, exactly right. Yes, reservoirs do a lot of really important things for the communities in which they reside, and you mentioned a number of them. In addition to those, if climate changes the way that it's supposed to, with more intense cycles of flooding and droughts, then reservoirs could really provide an important buffer against those changes.
Yeah, but your research suggests that reservoirs contribute to global warming. So it's a good thing, bad thing. How does this actually happen with reservoirs?
Yeah, well, so it turns out that reservoirs are a really good place to rot organic matter. And that makes a lot of methane. And methane is a really potent greenhouse gas. Mm. In fact, on a per molecule basis, it's about 35 times more potent than CO2.
So anything that falls in the reservoir, you know, that's organic is going to decompose and just fizzle out the methane.
That's right. Organic matter that's there when a reservoir is flooded will rot. Organic matter that flows in from upstream or grows in a reservoir will, when it rots in the absence of oxygen, can be converted to methane and then emitted to the atmosphere. And it turns out, like you said, when you add up all of the emissions of greenhouse gases from reservoirs around the world, that is a substantial source of greenhouse gas to the atmosphere. And you mentioned Canada. We don't have to beat up on Canada only. It's also a similar source in magnitude to important human sources like rice cultivation or the burning of biomass to make electricity. So it's a really important source, and yet it's not counted in the current UN accounting of greenhouse gases.
Is are you suggesting we don't build reservoirs anymore? Is that what this
research
suggests?
No, not at all. No, absolutely not. And rather, we're trying to round out the picture of what happens when a river is dammed so that policymakers and the general public have a better understanding of the consequences of every reservoir that's built.
Yeah, so that we get a better idea of the emissions, the balance of greenhouse gases coming and going.
Yeah, and actually one thing they're really excited about is the potential to site reservoirs in ways that reduce greenhouse gas emissions to the atmosphere and to manage the organic matter inputs to reservoirs that lead to those greenhouse gases eventually.
Yeah, all that agricultural runoff and things like that. Thank you, John.
Yeah, sure.
Dr. John Harrison, Associate Professor in the School of Environment at Washington State University in Vancouver, Washington. We're going to take a break and talk about what happens when your research catches the eye of Congress and why it's not always good news when that happens and how scientists may be suffering from it. We'll take a break and be right back after this break. Michael Mann will join us in this segment also. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. What happens when your research becomes a political flashpoint, when politicians decide to intimidate scientists whose research disagrees with their point of view? Case in point. Last year, a video from anti-abortion activists implied that Planned Parenthood was selling fetal tissue to research institutions. In response, the House of Representatives formed a Republican-led panel to investigate whether this was really happening. As of July, the panel has issued subpoenas to more than 80 companies, universities, and individuals that either research fetal tissue or are involved in its procurement for research. This is not a friendly inquiry. The panel is demanding emails, purchasing records, and names of staff or scientists involved. Scientists have condemned this panel's actions. An editorial this May in Nature Biotechnology even called it a witch hunt. And last month, the panel voted to recommend that one company, the tissue bank Stem Express, be held in contempt of Congress because CEO Kate Dyer did not provide full personnel records. Dyer said doing so would endanger her staff. We offered panel chair Marsha Blackburn, a Tennessee Republican, a chance to talk about and respond to these criticisms, and we're still waiting for our phone to ring or get a statement from her office. We will be waiting for that if it comes. Some of the scientists have received threatening emails full of abusive language. Have you ever been sued, harassed, or otherwise been intimidated because of your line of research? Give us a call, 844-724-8255. 844-SCI-TALK. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Let me introduce my first two guests. Carolyn Coyne is Associate Professor of Microbiology and Molecular Genetics at University of Pittsburgh. Eugene Gu is a surgical resident at Vanderbilt University Medical Center, graduate of Duke University Medical School, and CEO of Ganogen, a company he founded when he was a medical student. And now he's the subject of one of the congressional panel subpoenas and fears he, too, may be held in contempt of Congress. Welcome, both of you, to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much, Arifleta.
It's fine. Eugene, I want to ask you first. You wrote me a letter expressing concern about all of this, and you actually are fearful. Tell us why you are.
Yeah, even for today, I was afraid I was not even going to be on the air because Originally, I believe Science Friday is aired from a studio at Vanderbilt, and Vanderbilt actually canceled my appearance, and then they actually called me into a meeting and told me that they couldn't have me on, and I believe it has to do with the fact that Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn is the congresswoman who's very close to Vanderbilt and to the Nashville, Tennessee area where I'm doing my residency. And just even being here talking to you today has been an ordeal.
So the university canceled your appearance on Science Friday?
They canceled. There's a Vanderbilt studio where I was supposed to have been aired, but now I'm at a different studio in Nashville.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll look into that. But what did the subpoena ask for, Eugene? What kinds of things? And what was your response?
Yeah, they asked for a very broad range of documents, all the things I purchased as part of Ganogen in order to do my research. And just to explain to the public what my research is about, I transplanted human fetal hearts and human fetal kidneys into immunocompromised rats. And our goal, actually, is to save the lives of infants with severe congenital diseases, such as hypoplastic left heart syndrome, where babies are born with a non-functioning left ventricle, bilateral renal agenesis, where babies are born without a kidney. And if they don't have a heart transplant or a kidney transplant, they will basically not live to adulthood. And so this is one of our goals. And just doing this research, we got subpoenaed just out of the blue.
But you filed your paperwork, so you got subpoenaed and the problem solved, right?
No, I wish it was that simple. We filed our paperwork. I actually had a pro bono attorney because, you know, I'm just a surgical resident. I don't make very much money. I can't afford a high-powered D.C. lawyer. So I got an attorney, Andrew Herman, at a D.C. law firm who agreed to represent me free of charge. And we submitted the documents that they requested, you know, all the things that we purchased. And they released a July interim report which said that Ganogen was not compliant, not fully compliant with the subpoena. It was the same status that Stem Express had before they were charged with contempt of Congress. And in fact, there's a district attorney in Orange County, Tony Rakukas, who has charged another company, Da Vinci Biosciences, with a criminal charge for the sale of, quote, baby body parts. And so this is just part of this huge McCarthyist witch hunt, which is not only just giving us subpoenas, but threatening us with criminal action. And it's really chilling. It's very scary that this is happening in the United States of America.
Carolyn Coyne, how would you describe the climate for research involving fetal tissue?
Well, I would completely agree that I think the climate is changing, and I think that the pressure that is being put on, you know, basic scientists that I think are trying to answer really fundamental questions about, say, in some cases, human biology or, you know, diseases that are specific to the fetus, I think are really being intimidated. And I think that this is causing some scientists who may otherwise, you know, want to address their scientific questions using human fetal tissue. I think it's discouraging them from doing that. I think because we've all been seeing what's been going on within this, you know, this panel within the House as they're going after everyone else. And so I think the climate is certainly changing. And I think it's an area that most people have been, you know, have some reservation to entering in anyway. But I think this is certainly magnifying that. And I think there's a heightened sense of, I would say, some bit of fear, but certainly just, you know, overall, you know, trepidation about entering into this area.
So you feel like a bit of trepidation about actually talking about it in public?
Not me personally, no. I mean, you know, I think it's an important issue, and I think it's an issue that needs to be addressed. And I think putting the scientists who do this research, you know, that are driven by their own, you know, curiosity and a desire to help, you know, human health, I think it's important to put a voice to this issue. And so while there is a certain degree of trepidation about, you know, speaking publicly about it, I think it's an important issue that has to be addressed. So, you know, that at least hasn't prevented me from doing so.
Mm-hmm. Representative Blackburn's office did not have a statement, as I said before, in response to our questions, but she's previously said these subpoenas are vital to determining whether companies or researchers are breaking the law by profiting from the sale of aborted fetuses. What if this committee has the best of intentions, Carol?
Well, I mean, I think that one would hope that they would have the best of intentions. But, you know, I think it's important to note that, you know, to ensure that, you know, human fetal tissue research has been done with the very highest of ethical standards, you know, this research has been subject to very stringent laws and regulations for decades. You know, this is not a new phenomenon of utilizing human fetal tissue in research. I mean, this is the basis of many of the, the vaccines that we all use and, you know, have been saved by in many cases. And so for me, because of that, you know, the motives of the new panel seem to be really unclear. And, you know, I think what's particularly troubling is that as part of their investigation, you know, they're not just looking into how companies that might distribute the tissue are behaving. They're actually questioning whether we as scientists should be even able to conduct this research. And, you know, there was an interim report that this committee released over the summer, which basically stated that no cures have ever been made through the use of fetal tissue research, and used that to basically conclude that this research was outdated, and that there was really no reason, given all of the, you know, technical scientific advances we've had, to use the tissue. And so as much as you hope that the motivations are pure, you know, one would certainly wonder whether the panel serves more to, you know, I think not only intimidate the researchers that use the tissue, mm-hmm. but also to intimidate the women who seek elective terminations and certainly intimidate them into not, consenting to providing the fetal tissue for research purposes.
Mm-hmm. And just to interject a little bit right there, Ira, you said that what if the panel had the best interest of researchers or best interest of finding out what's going on in mind. I would say that if they did, why did they release on June 1st, 2016, the unredacted names and emails and phone numbers of all the researchers who were involved in fetal tissue research, including that of my brother? And also, I found it very intimidating when two armed U.S. marshals basically knocked on my apartment door during the day when I was sleeping. I was on call for trauma in the hospital for the past 28 hours, and this was my time to sleep. And I just woke up hearing this banging on my door, so I was a bit scared. I went to the door, and all I heard was, "This is the police, open up." And I was like, "Oh, you know, what is this for? You know, I don't want to open the door unless you have a warrant." And I remember very distinctly what they told me. They said, "We don't need a warrant. This is a congressional subpoena." And I was just like, "Wow. You know, this is, what kind of world do we live in where the Fourth Amendment doesn't even apply, that they can bang down your door and issue the subpoena?" So I opened the door. I got the subpoena from Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn, living in the same district as her, basically. And it's just very chilling. And on top of that, they have a mission statement on the website for the House Select Investigative Panel on Infant Lives, where they talk about they want to get to the bottom of the abortion providers who sell, quote, baby body parts. And when they say baby body parts, I want everyone to remember that in Colorado Springs, there was a madman who shot and killed three innocent people. And after he shot them and murdered them in cold blood, he said, "No more baby parts." The same thing that Marsha Blackburn, Diane Black, and all of these Congress people doing this witch hunt continue to say. And that this is on top of all these bogus criminal charges that they're filing against us as just simple researchers. And, you know, like, I'm not a big person. I'm a very ordinary, small individual. I'm not a professor. I don't have tenure at a university. When I was subpoenaed, I was an intern surgical resident, you know, basically making, like, minimum wage. Couldn't even afford an attorney. And this subpoena has made a big impact on my medical career, something that I've worked so hard for all these years to achieve. You know, in residency, especially in a surgical residency, if you have any kind of outsider status, it can really impact the way people trust you with patients. And so, like, on the wards, as I'm trying to take care of patients or in the operating room, I remember some senior residents are like telling me, "Are you Martin Scorsese? You know, are you under criminal investigation?" Just like that guy who, you know, inflated the price of a drug. And it's been very harrowing for me.
Well, we wish Marsha Blackburn and her office or any of these other people on the committee give us a call and able to, you know, to talk about their side of the story. But and maybe somebody now they're running for office. They're congresspeople. They're running for office. Maybe at a news conference, someone will ask them about this, and we'll get a statement or get some sort of back and forth with them. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Carolyn Coyne and Eugene Gu. Let me ask you, Carolyn, what have you heard from other researchers about these inquiries? Have they been intimidated like Eugene has?
Well, I think anyone certainly who has been subpoenaed to Congress, I think it's natural that you would feel intimidated and it would impact your, again, willingness to get into the research. I mean, I've certainly seen it within my own laboratory where, you know, people are less willing to, you know, to promote the fact that they are working in this tissue, despite the fact that this tissue provides a really vital resource for us. That is, you know, the reasons that we use it are based upon, you know, the scientific importance of the tissue. And so I've certainly seen how it has affected, I think, trainees. And I think that the point that was just made about, you know, it's certainly people that the solicitation of names of trainees, of our, you know, technicians and students and postdoctoral fellows who are in a much more sort of precarious situation than one might think a, you know, tenured faculty is. You know, that to me is what is as upsetting as anything. Because, you know, one might say that as a faculty member who has tenure, you can certainly share your opinion and your voice. But, you know, when you think about the lab workers and your trainees and them and their information, you know, being put onto, I would agree, what essentially turns into, you know, sort of a hit list, if you will. I think that's, you know, that's alarming. And as I said, I think what's going on has not just impacted people that are actively doing the research. I think it's as much, if perhaps not more, you know, influencing other researchers and preventing them from entering into this line of research. And I think that's a real shame because, you know, a lot of people have the knowledge and expertise that could be applied to these really important basic questions if they just used the tissue. But I do, and I've certainly directly sensed trepidation amongst others of not wanting to get into the fray.
Well, and states have been making it harder to use tissue, right, Dr. Coyne?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Give me some specifics.
Indiana is, I think, a perfect example. You know, there's the House Bill 1337 that was signed by former Governor Mike Pence that requires that all fetuses that arise from elective terminations be buried or cremated, and therefore makes it a felony to use that tissue for anything else. And so that also includes for research purposes. And so therefore, you know, not only is it are you then worried about being subpoenaed, you know, it then becomes a crime. It becomes a felony to use this tissue. A number of other states are already in the midst of trying to change their statutes and laws. Wisconsin tried last year. It didn't actually wind up going through in that legislative year. But a number of other states have implemented, different ways to restrict access to fetal tissue.
Mm. Eugene, last word.
And just to add on to that point. Yeah, I've actually put my research on hold when I started residency in July of 2015. And yet, despite putting my research on hold, Congresswoman Blackburn, Diane Black, they still issued me the subpoena. And that has been just almost ridiculous. And on top of that, I know, Carolyn, you do research with Zika virus.
I do.
What's ironic to me about this House investigative panel on infant lives is that they claim that they have infant lives at their best interest. But research into like what Carolyn's lab is doing, investigating Zika virus, preventing infant microcephaly, there was an article in the New England Journal of Medicine where they showed that the rates of elective abortion has increased in countries like in Brazil, where the Zika virus is raging. That's because women who are infected with Zika are afraid to give birth to children with severe birth defects. And now that Zika has gained a foothold in Florida, you know, researchers like Carolyn are very important for helping prevent, you know, elective abortions that Congresswoman Blackburn seems to be so against.
All right,
actually save infant lives.
All right, thank you both, Eugene Gu and Carolyn Coyne, Associate Professor of Microbiology and Molecular Genetics at the University of Pittsburgh. And we're going to take a break and talk more about this with climatologist Dr. Michael Mann, who has faced lawsuits, an email hack, and more. And we're going to switch to climate change now. And I'm going to have some advice for scientists who may someday be called to courtrooms to defend their work. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about science in the crosshairs, like fetal tissue researchers. Those working on climate science have had their own difficulties, including subpoenas, Twitter harassment, and more. My next guest is someone who has been defending himself and climate science for more than a decade. Michael Mann, whose 1999 work on the infamous hockey stick graph helped demonstrate that the globe is warming faster than ever before, later found himself in a different kind of hot spot. A House subpoena demanded his email, his notes in 2005. His email was hacked in 2009, ClimateGate incident, plus multiple lawsuits. Professor Mann's now the Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science and Director of the Earth Systems Science Center at Penn State University. He's also co-author of a new book with the Washington Post cartoonist Tom Tolles that touches on the politicalization of climate research, the madhouse effect, how climate change denial is threatening our planet. Also with us is Lauren Kurtz, Executive Director of the Climate Science Legal Defense Fund based at Columbia University. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
And thanks, Ira. Good to be with you.
Nice to have
Likewise,
you.
Likewise. Thank you.
And we want to ask our listeners if they've encountered harassment or lawsuits or other hurdles because of their scientific research. Give us a call, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. So you can call us 844-SciTalk. Let's talk about this. Michael Mann, tell us about your history of this. When did this all start?
Sure. Well, back in the late 90s, as you noted, we published this graph, the so-called hockey stick graph, that demonstrated how unprecedented modern warming is in a long-term context, showing the recent warming has no precedent for at least 1,000 years, and by implication, it probably has something to do with us, with human activity, with the burning of fossil fuels. And it became an icon in the climate change debate. And as a result of that, I found myself in the crosshairs of vested interests and the politicians advocating for them who sought to discredit my work as a way to try to discredit the entire case for concern over climate change, as if it all hinged on this one graph. But because this graph did become so iconic in the climate change debate, it provided an object for them to try to attack. I myself became an object to attack through efforts to intimidate me, discredit me, and harass me.
Mm-hmm. Personal attacks on you.
Yes, in some cases, very nasty emails, death threats, not just against me, but my family, a substance that was sent to me in the mail, a white powder that had to be investigated by the FBI. The list goes on and on. Of course, harassment by folks like Joe Barton, the former chair of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. In fact, Marsha Blackburn, whom you referred to in that previous segment, was also part of this congressional effort to harass and intimidate me back in 2005 by holding out the threat of a subpoena to demand all of my personal emails. Clearly, the idea was to search through my emails and my notes to find something, anything, with which to discredit me personally as a means of discrediting the iconic hockey stick, something that I'm sure the fossil fuel interests who so heavily fund Joe Barton and Marsha Blackburn would like to see.
Mm-hmm. Lauren Kurtz, to put this in perspective, what makes Dr. Mann's experience part of a larger trend? Why do we need a climate science legal defense fund at all?
Well, so our fund was actually founded in response to one of the cases against Mike. As he mentioned, he's really experienced the whole spectrum of what a scientist can see. But back in 2011, all these government attempts to get his emails had failed. And so a quote-unquote public interest group decided to try and use Virginia State's open records laws to go after his emails. And they filed an open records lawsuit trying to get all the emails he had written or received while he was employed by the University of Virginia. The University of Virginia was all set to hand over his emails. And he said, wait, no, this is terrible. And the scientific community rallied around him to raise money to fund his defense. And because it was so many people who put this in, there was kind of a fund that was established to help him. And the people who had envisioned this fund, I think, just expected it to be for Mike's case. But at that time, there were several other scientists undergoing similar open records cases, also by conservative groups that wanted some smoking gun email they could use to disprove the case on climate change. Since then, other scientists have gotten through the same thing. Actually, Mike mentioned his hockey stick paper. Mm-hmm. One of his co-authors is actually in litigation right now by the same group that failed against him in Virginia. They brought an open record suit in Arizona. That's currently underway. They're trying to get the same emails that he exchanged with Mike during the same time period, just in a different state. You know, Mike mentioned that he's gotten death threats. We're working with a scientist now, unfortunately, who's getting death threats. This is something that really hasn't gone away. If you are a scientist who puts out cutting-edge research, you can get a lot of professional accolades. But, you know, if there's a politician or some other politically, ideologically motivated group that doesn't like the implications of your work, you can expect to get a nasty response, too.
So there are a lot of, would you say there are dozens of scientists now?
Oh, yeah. Since we were started in 2011, we've helped about 100 researchers.
Wow.
Some of them, you know, it was just a quick thing. You know, this is what my university is doing. Is this sound right to you? And we'll say, yes, it's great. Other times, you know, it's something that we kind of help fund. We help take over. We help the scientists fight back. We get about maybe 5 big cases a year that we need to spend a lot of time on. And then the other ones are just kind of sanity checks or telling a scientist what their legal rights or responsibilities are, those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it is a real problem. Mike isn't the only scientist who has faced this.
Michael, in your book, The Madhouse Effect, you say that there's an attempt to name names in a coordinated effort to discredit climate science.
Yes, absolutely. There has been for years the same special interests that we're talking about, not just fossil fuel interests, but folks like the Koch brothers, who actually fund a lot of these so-called public interest groups that are behind these Freedom of Information Act demands against scientists. They have been looking to malign climate scientists, to discredit them personally as a means of, again, very cynically leading the public to think that the science of climate change is somehow heavily contested, when in fact there is a very widespread scientific consensus. Now, in the Madhouse Effect, what Tom Tolles, of course, the brilliant cartoonist for the Washington Post, and his cartoons are just so effective in really zooming in on issues like hypocrisy. And there's no greater hypocrisy than the hypocrisy of some of the politicians involved in the efforts to discredit climate scientists. We try to sort of throw some of that attitude back at the individuals who are behind this, not just fossil fuel interest groups, but talking heads that they fund, scientists with impressive credentials who have basically sold out to become advocates for fossil fuel interests and other special interests. We feel it's important for people to know what's going on. And sometimes you have to name names and make sure that there is you can't engage in personal attacks and efforts to defame scientists without being called out for that bad faith.
We heard our last guest, Eugene Gu, who actually wrote me about this. He was in such mortal fear when that door knock came. Actually, it was a pounding on his door. Is that common? Is that a common thing, Lauren, for that to happen? I mean, and do subpoenas have a higher weight than having a search warrant?
You know, every scientist I know who's gotten a congressional subpoena has been terrified. I guess that's the first I've heard of someone actually being delivered via the door. Usually it's by the mail or electronically. But still, you know, when you open that email or you open that letter, it's just this flood of panic. Mm-hmm. What does this mean? More commonly, scientists will also get letters, which don't necessarily have the weight of a subpoena. But first of all, the scientist doesn't necessarily see it that way. And second of all, that's still a terrifying thing to receive. You know, you get a letter from Lamar Smith has done a few of these lately. He's a Republican from Texas. He's chair of the House Science Committee, and he's taken his Science Committee chairmanship as an open door to go after all sorts of scientists who he doesn't like. He sent lots of letters to people in the climate science community saying, I'm watching you. You know, I want your emails. I want more information on your funding sources. Or even just, you know, I'm watching you. Be prepared. You might hear more from me later.
Yeah, well, we've been inquiring his office for years, so we haven't gotten a return to have him come on Science Friday. So let me ask both of you. So what's your advice? What should researchers do if they want to avoid a suit or make it through one of these cases?
Well, I can draw on my own personal experiences. I was a fairly young scientist at the time, back in the late 1990s, I was not... I really had no experience that could have possibly prepared me for the onslaught of attacks, threats of congressional subpoenas, the sorts of intimidation efforts that I was being subject to. A career in science does not prepare you for defending yourself in the public sphere when you're under assault from heavily funded vested interests like fossil fuel interests. So you sort of have to, back when I had to deal with these attacks in the late 1990s, it was pretty much up to you to find a way to defend yourself. Now, fortunately, there is a larger infrastructure that has developed to help scientists who find themselves in these situations. Lauren's work with the Climate Science Legal Defense Fund is so important. It provides young scientists who find themselves under attack some place to go to get advice, to make sure that they don't do something stupid in those initial few hours when you find yourself at the receiving end of, say, a congressional subpoena or a Freedom of Information Act demand. And, of course, the Union of Concerned Scientists has done so much work in trying to help scientists deal with these sorts of bad faith assaults. They have a wonderful guide book that's available electronically on their website about how to deal with intimidation. What I would say to a scientist who finds themselves in this sort of situation is, first of all, recognize that this isn't personal. As personal as it might seem, you're being attacked in this way because your research is important, and there are vested interests who are intimidated by the powerful nature of your research findings. So understand that it isn't personal. It's really an effort to try to discredit the science you're doing because the science is so important. The second thing I would say is don't just act out of frustration or fear. Respond initially to these subpoenas, Freedom of Information Act requests, until you've had a chance to consult with legal experts, to consult with colleagues who have experience dealing with these sorts of attacks. Make sure you understand your rights. Don't assume that your university or institution will necessarily do what's best for you, because sometimes the interests of the institution and your interests aren't necessarily aligned. So you need your own representation. And fortunately, again, there are there are organizations like the Climate Science Legal Defense Fund, like the Union of Concerned Scientists, that are there to help you make sure you understand your rights, make sure that you, you're able to defend yourself against these sorts of attacks.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International, talking with Professor Michael Mann about his new book, The Madhouse Effect, How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet. And Lauren Kurtz, Executive Director of the Climate Science Legal Defense Fund, based at Columbia University. In the few minutes I have left, Dr. Mann, what are you looking at? Now, this coming election is, when we hear talking about climate science, it must be crucial.
Yeah, in the galleys of our book was actually finalized, and we realized there wasn't a cartoon about Donald Trump. and so we were able to fix that in the end, because really we couldn't be faced with a more fundamental choice in this next election between a candidate who, on the one hand, a candidate like Donald Trump, who rejects the overwhelming science of climate change, who's dismissed it as a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese, and a candidate, on the other hand, Hillary Clinton, who wants to build on the tremendous successes we've made under the Obama administration and move forward. She recognizes the importance of tackling what is an existential threat that we face, the threat of human-caused climate change. There's still time to act, but there is no time to delay. And so this is a make-or-break election as far as stabilizing climate change below dangerous, indeed catastrophic levels. This as goes this election, will go the climate. And I would encourage your listeners to make sure that they vote on the climate, and not just at the top of the ticket, but all the way down in this next election. It couldn't be more important.
Lauren, you get the last word.
Yeah, well, first of all, I would echo get out and vote. I'd also like to just circle back the previous answer that Mike gave. I agree with everything he said about, you know, a scientist who's fearful or, you know, currently under siege. I also would, you know, advise maybe getting out in front of this. If you think this is a possibility, it's not a bad idea to research what your legal rights and responsibilities are beforehand. We talked to a lot of scientists who are very surprised that open records laws might apply to them. If you are a publicly funded scientist, either at a public university, you're employed by the federal government, if you even get federal government grants, it is a very good idea to understand exactly what taking that public money might mean in terms of having to hand over your emails, having to hand over your documents. I mean, there are protections in place in many jurisdictions, but in some there are not. And even, you know, for federal grants, you may be responsible for turning over certain information under a public records request. What? So just be prepared.
An unprecedented time in your experience?
Yeah, I mean, the increasing politicalization of climate change or, you know, climate science, I think it has really put scientists who are doing good, respectable work into this position where they're under investigation and they're under attack. And it's really wild and not okay.
That's the last word. Well, certainly not the last word on the topic, but it is for this hour. Lauren Kurtz is executive director of the Climate Science Legal Defense Fund based at Columbia. You have a website on that, I'm sure.
Yes, climatesciencedefensefund.org.
And
I was just going to say, anyone who has a question, we have a contact form. Feel free to send us an email. We have lawyers on the team. We have pro bono assistance available. Please, any legal questions, send it our way. Mm-hmm.
Michael Mann, distinguished professor of atmospheric science and director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University, and author of the new book, The Madhouse Effect, How Climate Change and Denial is Threatening Our Planet. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ira.
Charles Berquist is our director, senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Christy Taylor, Katie Heiler, Lou Groskin, our video producer, Rich Kim, our technical director, Sarah Fishman, and Jack Horowitz, our engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. Just a clarification, I wanted to note that Vanderbilt University did not cancel Eugene Gu's appearance on the show, but did discourage him from participating today, just to set the record straight. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.